Hello, and welcome to the Movie Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll have a spoiler-filled discussion about a movie we think you'll enjoy. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the film Wanted from, I think, 2008, which is based on the Wanted miniseries that Sam and I have discussed in Back Issue Spotlight. And as Sam and I had discussed in that episode, and as I'm sure we'll discuss quite a bit here, while the basic high-level plot of, you know, the son of an assassin gets forced into the family business... There are some huge differences between the comic version and the movie version.
I can see that. I would expect that.
A certain amount I would expect. The whole Loom of Fate aspect wasn't in the comic at all.
Okay.
In place of that, in the comic, it was essentially a riff on what if the villains had kind of taken over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And divided up into factions. They were the fraternity. And two of the factions kind of go to war. The Lex Luthor and Superman family of villains versus the Joker and Batman family of villains.
Okay.
And a lot of the characters were very much parallels on or derivative of DC villains. Although they were unique enough on their own.
Mm-hmm.
The Morgan Freeman character here... closest analog was to the one that was kind of the Lex Luthor type.
Okay.
There was a mention of a Rictus having been killed, and that was kind of the Joker equivalent and such. And Fox was kind of the Catwoman sort. So they did quite a bit of referencing in the comic to the DC universe or their version thereof. You know, a trip to an Earth 2 kind of a thing, etc. The whole concept of supervillains was pretty much nowhere to be had in here. I say pretty much because the opening bit, when the guy was kind of rushing to jump to the other building, that reeked, in my opinion, of super speed.
Yes. Super something.
Super something. And the whole, your heart's beating, you know, 400 times a minute or whatever, to me got to the beyond peak human into the superhuman ability.
Yeah.
And in the comic, his father was kind of sort of the equivalent of Deathstroke the Terminator. His code name was The Killer.
Ooh.
Yeah. A lot of the names, not particularly brilliant. But I think that was part of the point.
This seemed to be more of a assassin, by definition, is considered bad, but we're doing something good, so... we're the bad guys, but we're doing a good function, so we're the good guys of the movie.
What was interesting is in here, they really could have gone, because again, they are the weapons of fate. They never went for the, we are soldiers, not assassins.
Yeah.
You know, we are the army of fate, destiny, what have you. And I think there was a chance to have that discussion when he's like, I don't know if I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fox, Angelina Jolie's character... gives basically a sob story of, well, you know, if you don't, bad things might happen, versus actually trying to proactively justify it as not only can bad things happen, but we're here for a reason. We may seem like we're doing bad things, but we're doing them for good reason, just like soldiers are, you know, put in the position where they have to kill people to defend or whatever.
They seemed to be giving the impression that the Loom of Fate was giving them the names of the people that basically were skating by or past the justice system. So they were a secondary form of justice.
They needed to be taken out. The whole concept of justice didn't even seem to go in there, because it seemed like in some cases they may be preemptively taking somebody out. So it's not like somebody had done something bad and gotten through the justice system. It's just the way this tapestry was woven says they must die.
That's a very unkind tapestry.
It is. It is. And...
you know, and really, I mean, as he put, I mean, what you call a code, I call a mistake. I mean, the loom skipped a stitch.
Well, it seemed like you could pick and choose which part of the thing you look at to get the result you want or something.
And somebody did.
Yeah.
Well, and the moment that they pointed out that only one person reads the loom, translates and decodes the loom, presents the results, sees the loom at all.
Kind of, this is the one time you'll ever be in this room, otherwise it's mine kind of a thing.
Yeah. My suspicion radar went off. I'm like, so we were being told to trust you, but now we're told, oh, hey, wait a second. Maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was an aspect of who could Wesley trust, you know, who really killed his father and all that mm-hmm. stuff in the comic. And there was a twist in the comic, and there was a different twist here.
Well, here, from the moment Wesley meets these people, and that's when the movie actually should have started in some respects. Because leading up to that was whole different movie.
I think we needed to know what a loser he was before. I don't know that we needed as much time.
Yes.
But we got that in the first, you know, handful of pages of the first issue in the comic. And then when he meets the fox in the comic, he's like at a fast food place and she basically mows down everybody there to get his attention.
I think it could have been done in less than, it felt like over 10 minutes.
We should have noted the time for how long it got in there. It did feel excessive. And to me, that's the sort of thing that you can set up pretty quickly, pretty effectively, you know, and then move on.
Mm-hmm.
And it did take a while to get to that. I think I would say it was probably longer than 10 minutes before we got to that.
It felt forever.
I would say it was probably closer to 30 minutes before we got to the scene where he was there with Morgan Freeman and Angelina Jolie getting the, you know, do you want to find out who you are or what your father, you know, did and stuff?
Yeah.
Because I think they paced that for kind of the first major plot point of the movie.
For the first probably 15 minutes of the movie, I was tempted to ask you if you were sure you had picked up a superhero or villain or super anything movie and not The Office or some...
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
Well, and the part that got me with their office thing at the beginning was it's a cubicle farm and all of the power cables are like draped almost like Christmas decorations or whatever. And I'm like, it reeks of, you know, we're only going to be shooting here for a couple of days, so do we really need to go wire the thing correctly?
Mm-hmm.
It was, if you had asked me if I'd picked up a superhero film, I would have told you I'd picked up the equivalent of a summer blockbuster.
Mm, that's a good one for it. And I guess that's what I wasn't feeling in those first 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, but there were a couple of scenes where, particularly with the car chases, I felt we very much got Hollywood blockbuster.
There was one where I'm like, if they didn't do a behind the scenes how we shot it, they should have. And that's when James McAvoy is kind of crouching in on himself with, okay, all these people can just go away, whatever this is, I don't want part of it. And the red sports car comes to the rescue.
Oh, and scoops him up.
And spins. And as it spins towards him, he ends up in the passenger seat.
I think I've seen behind the scenes footage on that. I'm not sure if we've got it here on the Blu-ray or not, or if I'd seen it on YouTube or whatever. A lot of that, I think, was digital.
I believe it, because, I mean, it was just beautiful.
Because, yeah, she kicks open the door or whatever, spins around, and he literally gets scooped up into the car.
Yeah.
And there is no way you could have done that without pretty much killing the person.
Pretty much, but it was beautiful.
Yeah.
On screen. I mean, however long it took them to put that together, and I mean literally put that together,
well,
it was worth it. They did a beautiful job.
You've got to have the shot of him kind of standing there, crouching or whatever, another of the car kind of spinning around, and then again, some computer magic, you know, mixing it all together and editing it to where it looks just right.
Yeah.
And the one where he's trying to shoot the guy in the limo, it's bulletproof glass. She shoots ahead in the sports car, spins around to face him, slams on the brakes, so her car points down. He, I guess, kicks on the gas to his kicks up so he can use hers as a ramp to flip it over so he can shoot through the sunroof and stuff.
Because he couldn't curve a bullet at that point enough to do what he needed because the bullet would have had to U-turn, maybe?
Well, he certainly couldn't curve it well enough, but Angelina Jolie's the Fox character at the end, she was curving it, like, circularly.
Yeah.
So it literally got back to where she'd fired it from.
Yes. But we'll just allow that in that one moment, the bullet could not curve the way it needed to. But then...
It wouldn't have been as dramatic as flip the car over the other one and shoot from above.
And have him say, I'm sorry, just like he did to the police officers when the red car flipped over them.
Yeah, yeah. There was really good over-the-top car chase scenes and effects and action. Mm-hmm.
The other effect that was over-the-top, and yet I found myself loving it, was when he and Cross would fire bullets at each other and they would hit.
They'd kind of, the bullets would meet and nullify each other or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a certain, I'm going to block that bullet with my bullet.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous, but it was good. And again, the fact that they'd gone into how their adrenaline rush and hyperactive senses allowed them to see things others just couldn't and react faster,
mm-hmm.
made that, I'm not going to say plausible, but at least within the so-called logic of the universe.
Well, and at that point, what they had set up was that Wesley was the only person that could go up against Cross.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know why. We had a good theory at that point, but we didn't know for sure. But this idea that they're so evenly matched, that they can knock one another's bullets, it was fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we've seen that sort of deflection sort of a thing with other more practical weapons for it in the past, so I thought it was good. It surprisingly didn't really get into kind of the gun-fu stuff of Hong Kong films.
Mm.
You know, the Chow Yun-fat and stuff like that. But it had, I think, some really good action sequences. There was definitely a lack of subtlety in the movie. It was more gory than I had recalled, and there were a couple of things that, just from an action sequence point of view, were utterly ridiculous. Like in the big fight at the end, he's kind of crashing into their headquarters and stuff. And as he's running out of bullets in his guns, he's able to be kind of scooping up the guns from everybody around him that still happen to have enough bullets for him.
I love the one that the other guy drops upside down. He catches it still upside down and can fire the trigger on it.
Yeah.
In the upside down position. I'm like, I'm not quite thinking through how the mechanics of that work, but clearly
really
you
strong
are.
Pinky, you know, or it's a hair trigger.
I think I commented right before that scene. I'm like, and we know he doesn't count bullets.
Mm-hmm.
We've established this much about the character.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and at one point he seemed to reload, and I'm like, where did he have the other magazine?
That, if you're thinking what I'm thinking, that was like back at the parking garage.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, with the plastic bag. And I'm like, no, you have a plastic bag, you put a gun in it. There was no other magazine.
Yeah, it had the gun, you fired the bullets from the gun. You've clearly, because he made a thing like he's putting another magazine in, but I'm like, where did that come from?
Yeah, and I'm like, if you pulled the magazine out to check how you're doing and put it back in, newsflash, you're out. Mm-hmm. We watched you go click, click, I have no more. So, yeah.
There were a very few times, I can only think of that and maybe one or two others, where we saw somebody reloading. And it seemed like whenever people needed to reload, everybody needed to reload at the same time.
Well, the thing that we saw briefly, and I think it was only in the pharmacy, was like the gun that had like six sections that went around the corner.
That Angelina Jolie's character used. The part that got me is it was an articulated gun where you had a trigger part, then a hinge, a part of it, and another hinge, and another part. So it could, you know, shoot almost like in a U-turn or whatever.
Yeah.
And it could go a whole, you know, 180 or something in each thing, and she would just kind of flick the wrist.
Yeah.
And it would kind of, you know, articulate to where just where she needed. I'm like, how do you aim that?
Yes. Flip it to the left, fire and hit. Flip it to the right, fire and hit.
Now, at one point, it did have a
mirror.
A screen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
It was a monitor to where presumably there's a camera on the end or whatever. But how do you get it to stop, you know, at like 30 degrees versus 60 degrees or whatever where you need it to?
Well, and the pharmacy was one of the first places where we saw what Wesley had been thinking were panic attacks, mm-hmm. what he was going through. And I'm like, okay, so we have the one sign that he kind of focuses on for a second, and it's like, best shot. And then we have another sign that says last chance or something to that effect. Like, so it's like he's getting subliminal messages from the store advertising.
It was the second time we'd seen it, the first clear one, because previously when he was getting harassed by his boss, it's like we could see the sound waves and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I couldn't tell what was going on at that point because he was kind of not zoning in on anything in particular. Yeah, you're right.
There were a couple of things where I think the visual language they were trying to establish could have been a little clearer, but it worked well enough. There were a few other things, like the magic bath that would heal him or whatever.
Okay, was it hot or cold?
I'm assuming cold.
But sometimes steam came out of it.
I don't know.
But it was like a frozen block of ice that you could rest a bottle of vodka on. And yet when it cracked, it was like steam came out. So I don't know.
I couldn't tell what the goal of that was. The whole bit of him getting the tar beaten out of him was from the comic.
Interesting.
The you've got to get used to bullets entering a body was from the comic. Not exact scene for scene, but very close.
That was kind of funny, though.
Yeah.
That was very much a he is not of, I was going to say this world, which I mean, it's not like he's an alien or anything, but he is not of the assassin's world.
He was too, in the comic, much of a kind of a milquetoast, a wimp, sensitive individual, or whatever phrase you want to use, not a cold-blooded killer who could deal with all the gore and stuff.
Well, to me, he was just too naive in the ways of, yeah, they're going to use a real dead body.
Well, and that was something in both the comic and the movie where it's like, this kid's not built for this world, so we're going to tear him down and build him for this world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, working in a slaughterhouse, which was the equivalent of what the knives guy was doing here.
Yeah.
So he could get, you know, desensitized to the blood and the guts.
Mm-hmm. I just think that there was a fallacy to their logic at that point in terms of you're building him up to exist in this world. You believe he's the son of someone extremely capable and therefore has the potential to be at least somewhat, if not extremely capable.
You're turning him into a very dangerous weapon. Can you control it?
He has the potential to become your worst enemy.
I think we saw that.
But they never considered that possibility.
I disagree. I think that Morgan Freeman's character had, which is why once he sent Wesley after his father, he immediately sent the fox after Wesley.
Yes.
It's like, I need this weapon around long enough to do one job.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of things with the train wreck that defied rational thought, physics, etc.
Yes.
How the fox happened to be where she needed to be in the one train car at the right time, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. How she got out of there back home, I'm also not sure.
I don't know how he got out of the gorge. I mean, I know who says they got him out.
Yeah, apparently, because the last time we'd seen that guy, who was played by Terrence Stamp, who also played Zod, an amazing number of the people in the film have been in other comic films. We'll get to that later. He was last seen in a car outside the train station, presumably followed Fox as she was, you know, driving her car eventually into the train, and then...
Into/onto.
Into.
Well, but I mean, she didn't just hit the train. She got onto.
Well, onto could mean on the roof, and this was true. In the body of the train. What got me, though, is by the time the train crashed, it was going through tunnels and stuff. There were no roads nearby, and even if there were, they would have been up at the train level, not down in the gorge level.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how that guy would have possibly been able to get to Wesley, much less known where Wesley was to have been gotten to. But that was just kind of a wave of the hands and, you know, we're here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Wesley was played by James McAvoy, who, of course, went on to play Charles Xavier in the First Class series of X-Men film. Angelina Jolie played Lara Croft in the Tomb Raider films. Technically, it's a video game character, but there have been enough Tomb Raider comics that related. And she is in the perpetually upcoming Eternals film.
Okay.
As one of those characters. Cersei, I think, but I could be wrong on that. Morgan Freeman was in the Christian Bale Batman films as Lucius Fox.
Mm-hmm. I'm
trying to think if he's done other superhero-y type films. Terrence Stamp was Zod in Superman 2 back in the day.
Wesley's alleged best friend.
His best friend was Chris Pratt from Guardians of the Galaxy, Star-Lord. Who else? Were there? I'm not sure what else Common had been in.
I don't know. I didn't think to look him up.
He might have been in some other films that were superhero related.
It wouldn't surprise me.
And part of it is, you know, there was a point at which somebody doing two superhero films, it's like, what are the odds of that? Now it's like, pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, when you've got, you know, Batman, a Batman actor playing the Vulture. In stuff, and you've got some of these people who've played multiple roles on, you know, all three sides of the aisle, if you will, DC, Marvel, and other.
Well, and that's the thing. It used to be kind of a, once you were in one universe, you were, I don't want to say limited to that universe, but...
I think there's still some discussions that happen.
There are definitely discussions that happen. I've heard actors say at panels, you know, I had to get all kinds of waivers signed to be allowed to play this character in this other universe. There was, within the past few weeks, I think, but anyways, recently during the pandemic, there was a short made that's available on YouTube that was made as a fundraiser for basically the behind the scenes industry and professionals in the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
For the makeup artists, the transpo drivers.
The army of people it takes to make one of these films.
Right, because there are so few productions compared to normal going on. And what really intrigued me is it was a lot of the people from Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Mm-hmm.
who made the short, and the star of it was the one who played Deke.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Jeff Ward.
Uh-huh.
And guess who he plays in the short? Batman.
Oh, that's funny.
So it was kind of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. presents their version of Batman.
They should have done Nighthawk.
And, well, what they did actually was a documentary where Batman is having to raise money because, unfortunately, Alfred is out with COVID-19. And without Alfred there to keep everything together, Bruce Wayne made a few poor decisions with the Wayne fortune, and he's now having to raise some money.
Well, what's funny is it's the Lucius Fox character that would have been the one to do the money decisions, not Alfred, but still.
That's funny.
Yeah, so. Yeah. You look at a film like this, and there were a ton of characters in it.
Yes.
A lot of extras, a lot of, you know, there was the name characters, but then kind of all the other assassins, all the victims and such, and it takes a lot of work to put something like this together.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of places where I noticed a few minor Easter eggs here and there. The cubicle there at the end, the name on it was J.G. Miller.
Mm.
J.G. Jones was the artist. Mark Millar was the writer.
Nice.
Like somebody was just trying to, you know, do a nod to that. So Mark Millar has done a number of properties. This is one of his earlier ones. And a number of other ones have been turned into films. This was, I think, one of the ones that really, I think, started to get him seriously noticed.
Well, you've got the Sloan character who abuses a situation of absolute authority, which gives it an interesting level going on there. Then you've got Fox and the gunsmith, who in that final scene have two very different reactions.
Well, Gunsmith's, I thought, was more aligned with Sloane's, and the Fox's was very much a true believer approach.
Yeah. But neither of them, and part of it is limitations of time and what you can put on the screen, nobody was asking, basically, Sloane's name came up first, right?
Did he save us, or, you know,
are we
being punished for not having taken him out?
Were we condemned for following him?
Yeah, yeah. They never really got into the moral question of any of this. And that goes back to they could have treated them as if they were soldiers or Are they on the right or are they, you know, on the wrong? Is there a good fate and a bad fate kind of thing? But this was very much a action-adventure movie, not a philosophical thing.
Yeah.
And in the comics, it was very much a, in my mind, a kind of tribute to the power of continuity. Because while you could follow the story fine without understanding the DC universe, it becomes so much more real and recognizable if you understand the references.
Mm.
You know? It's like going to an art museum and saying, okay, I like the look of that painting, I like the look of that painting, and having a good time, versus somebody who's going there and understanding the schools of art, the brushstroke, and some of those things. It's a different kind of enjoyment. Neither's better or worse.
We had a guide at one museum back in the early 90s who had, because admittance to the museum was free,
mm-hmm.
for locals, had gone to that museum every day after school.
Mm-hmm.
And just, that was where he spent his spare time, basically. And when he gave us that tour, one of the things I remember was he knew the art so well that he could tell by looking at them which ones were reproductions that were put on display while the original was either having some work done on it for repairs or was out touring, but they didn't want people to miss the experience and stuff. And because it was in Russia, he would point out that all of the reproductions had some piece of propaganda.
Mm.
And in one of them, he was showing us it was a woman with a baby sitting on her lap. And he said, look at how her hand is holding the book. This is a reproduction. And that's why there's a book and she's reading to the child. In the original, she's holding a pomegranate. And the way the hand is holding the fruit is natural.
But you would not hold a book that way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just remember being so in awe of the familiarity he had with the art and the depth of understanding that came from viewing it so much and with so much depth.
Well, and that was the sort of thing that really came out in the comic for me, is Mark Millar really understood the DC universe and not just the continuity of it. Because the villains took over in 1986 at the time of Crisis on Infinite Earths. There was a reference to the first, you know, trans-timeline team-up of villains, which coincided with the first, I think, JLA-JSA team-up where that happened, and things like that, you know, referencing particular years and stuff. But also the way the character dynamics sort of worked.
Mm.
How the Batman family of villains is different than the Superman ones and stuff like that. And so there's this whole layer of the comic that I'm sure when they're thinking, okay, let's do a film on this, they're like, yeah, I don't think we can do this. One, logistics, economics, it would be really expensive to try to do a super villain kind of major motion picture, even in 2008.
Yeah.
But then there's also the legal logistical issues of how close can we get to, you know, these Superman and Batman villains without running afoul.
Mm-hmm.
Either of lawsuits or people thinking, well, this is just derivative.
Yes. Yeah.
So to have stripped that level totally out and kind of changed the window dressing, if you will, or the world in which it's happening, and still have the story pretty much run true. I think the whole bit with the Loom of Fate and all of that was in place of the Fraternity of Supervillains.
Mm.
They had to replace it with something.
Mm-hmm.
And because you didn't have the world carved up by the supervillains into fifths and whatnot, you didn't have the five factions with two warring and three kind of keeping it at a stalemate or something. So the ending of the film with Freeman's character basically saying, well, yeah, I faked it. What would you have me have done, you know?
Yeah.
That had to come from somewhere. That whole plot line was to replace what was, you know, removed out of it, and still gives you kind of the infighting mm-hmm. of the fraternity
yeah.
to keep the crux of the story the same.
Well, and that's where I kind of liked how they differentiated Fox from the Gunsmith, in terms of the Gunsmith almost ended up being on the side of, Yeah, I wasn't here with some great belief about why we were killing. I was killing.
The only person we know why is in the fraternity is the Fox, other than Wesley.
But it's a question of whether or not we actually believe the story she told.
I don't even think it's a question of if we believe, and I think that is a fair question. My point was that we have no idea why the gunsmith or any of these other people
agreed
are there.
But technically, what we know is she tells a story, and years later, she came into the fraternity. So we don't know that her coming into the fraternity has anything to do with the story she told, even.
Or if the story was real, made up, exactly. If it was about her, etc. I agree with that. It's just we don't even get any sense of motivation or history or anything for any of the other characters. And that's something that in the comic, just by reference to the equivalent of the Morgan Freeman character is this super scientist and, you know, it's he becomes quickly identifiable as, oh, that's the Lex Luthor. Just by the naming convention, if you will.
Well, we had, minimal, even I would say, personality for the guy with the blades.
Mm-hmm.
Sir Punches a Lot. I forget his real name.
Well, that's the thing, is I'm not sure I could tell you their names. There was the guy who beat up Wesley. There was the guy with the knives. There was the gunsmith, Common. There was the Fox, Angelina Jolie's. And
the Russian.
The Russian. With the rats and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they were, in my mind, less characters, more plot devices.
I was going to say placeholders, so with the exception of Fox. So you're...
They're functional roles. Yeah. They're not people.
Yeah.
It's like you need somebody who's the cab driver or the checkout clerk at the grocery store. They're not integral characters. Here, they showed up a lot, but they were there to serve a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we never got to know these people really at all outside of that plot function they filled.
Well, and they really had minimal personality within their plot function.
Yeah.
So.
Well, once you remove the Russian accent from the Russian, is there much there?
Well, he was crazy.
Well, and the guy with the knives, you know, they were shorthand characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were not fully fleshed out.
Well, and it was clear none of them were taking time to relate to or build a friendship with Wesley, and we were given no reason why.
Yeah.
It could be they knew the truth about Cross. Not about Sloan, about Cross.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, would you want to buddy up to someone who you knew was going to be sent to kill their own father?
Well, particularly since, you know, they may not be appreciative of that after the fact.
Yeah.
Presumably they knew he was Cross's son. They clearly didn't know what Sloan was up to. There's a lot of that backstory that's just nebulous, and if you think about it too hard, it raises a lot of questions. They're not, I want to say they're not integral to the story, because it's very enjoyable without thinking about it, but the minute you think about it, you realize they are kind of integral to the backstory.
Well, we went into Sloan's library-style office multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
What if each time we had gone in there, he had been casually slipping into that folder we see at the end, one of these members, the gunsmith, Fox, whoever, names that he was just discreetly not putting a hit on? So that when that comes out later, we have the answer to the question of the Loom of Fate has called them recently or seemingly recently.
Yeah. I did think it was weird that after pulling the name out of the coded part of the loom, it would then get cut out.
Yes, and yet the loom, the woven stuff seemed all in one piece without
holes.
Totally
intact without that, yeah.
Yeah, it was a very magical loom and tapestry.
Yes.
Or cloth or whatever it was weaving.
Well, and it seemed to, when the place got destroyed, explode in size. Because while it had, you know, hundreds of threads going into it, it was all very orderly and stuff. And then afterwards, after the destruction, I mean, you couldn't move a few inches without hitting a thread.
That was funny.
And there seemed to be the equivalent loom over in the monastery that seemed to be of an equivalent design of this place.
What got me was when Wesley leaves, finally, at the end of the big fight. He's walking out through the courtyard, and there are these two... I mean, they're not much bigger than his foot. skeins of the thread out on the ground. And I'm like, yeah, those tiny skeins of thread have been making those big sheets.
Well, and also, how did they get out there intact from these rat-sized bombs? Because they would have had to been sitting somewhere, have the blast, you know, it's, I don't know, it just didn't make sense.
Oh,
not supposed to, and I'm sure you're not supposed to think about it that way, but...
No, they were just establishing we were at the textile factory.
Yeah.
That was an awesome looking building.
I'd like to know where that was shot, because it had a very brick castle look to it.
Yeah, that was awesome.
That I'd like to see more of. And when they did the fade or the cut from there to the monastery on the other side of the world or whatever.
That was funny.
And the two kind of lined up. It made me wonder if this textile factory just happened to look enough like it they could sell it, or if it was digital.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
So some of the stuff there was really cool. And it was a fun film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've watched it since I'd seen it originally.
I hadn't.
And I remember enjoying it originally. Mm-hmm. It was fun. It was over the top. It was ridiculous.
As long as you can accept that bullets don't have to fly in a straight line, you're good to go.
You've got to go on the assumption physics works differently in this world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can literally curve bullets.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Mythbusters felt the need to try to myth-bust that in and of itself is...
Now, technically, I think they aren't curving the bullet. They're curving the bullet's trajectory.
Yes. But they did have an episode where it's like, okay, can we fling the bullet? And it's like, yeah, that's not going to work.
That's hilarious, though.
Hey, you know, when you've done Mythbusters for 10 seasons plus, or I don't know how long into it they were, you're going to run out of myths.
I thought the funniest one with a bullet was if putting a bullet to connect something in the steering wheel column. I'll Google it and share it with you. There's something in certain vehicles where if there's not a connection between these two things, you can't start the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
It's like pickup trucks or something, but it's the exact size the bullet will fit. So some people have shoved a bullet in there and been able to start the pickup. And the question was, does enough heat, whatever, generate...
Does enough electricity, is it enough to trigger the gunpowder?
Yeah. So they myth-busted it.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
Kind of the, could you get shot driving your pickup?
Well, if you drive it with a bullet that way, maybe. Yeah, the whole concept of gun safety in this film, the whole thing was, it was fun action, but it was ridiculous.
Yeah. You know? But we're back to some of it was just beautiful. Impossible, but beautiful.
Mm-hmm. There was some of that, but there was also some that it was just gory for the sake of gory.
Yes.
But in keeping with the over-the-topness of the comic.
I believe that.
I mean, the breaking of the fourth wall there at the very end of the film is very similar to how the comic ended.
Hmm.
With kind of a direct address, not visually, but through the captions, to the audience.
Yeah, what have you been doing lately compared to that character?
So...
And they drained his bank account when they went to kill him.
Yeah, that was never really kind of explained or whatever.
Well, if you're going to kill somebody, why leave him any money?
In the comic, the twist was the father has faked his death, but knew he was getting past his prime. Somebody was going to end up taking him out, and he wanted to be somebody worthy, which would be like his son if he could turn him worthy, versus just some other punk getting lucky. So he does end up killing his father in the comic, but that's like the climax of the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, versus... We had this whole end game afterwards.
Yeah. Well, what got me in the film was when he shot his father.
Yeah. You're dangling from this train over a gorge. The guy trying to pull you up is your father. And you said, you know what? Now's a good time to shoot him.
Yeah, right.
How they managed to get scooped up by the train and then... into the crevasse or whatever.
His father used his dying breath.
That's right, to pull him up.
To lurch backwards and save him.
Yeah, and what's funny is they get pulled into the train car, which is now detached from the rest of the train. It goes into the gorge, winds up, instead of being, you know, end to end, top to bottom, it's now level again, scrapes against both sides, which is just perfectly a little narrower than train shape. To kind of get wedged in there. And it wedges in straight down. It doesn't, like, twist back and forth. You flip them over or anything.
Well, but they ended up on one of the windows.
You're right. It was on its side. So
technically, they were each on a window to begin with.
Yes. But there was aspects of that that... How are you surviving at that point?
Yes.
Because that had to be kind of bumpy or whatever. Fun film. Good cast. A lot of familiar faces.
Yes.
Not one that I ever expect to see a sequel to either in the comics or in film. Although the comic was open to a sequel. Arguably the movie is too. Not going to happen. But Mark Millar, for the most part, doesn't revisit properties. Mm. He's done it a few times, but it's more the exception than the rule.
Okay.
He's more of a library builder than a sequel writer. So.
I enjoyed it. It was a good film. I mean, it's light fun versus deep and, oh, wow, I can think this through.
It's definitely not deep and, oh, wow, and I enjoyed it, but I'll be honest, it was a little gorier in places than I had recalled, and I have seen action movies I thought were more fun.
It was definitely cover my eyes moments, but maybe I watched too much entertainment. It's not often I see something like with the car scooping him up, where I'm like, wow, that's just beautiful. Haven't seen that.
Definitely had some inventive and more kind of clever, interesting, out there, out of the box kind of action sequences.
Yeah.
Again, the scooping him up, the bullet deflecting bullet, those sorts of things. I enjoy that aspect of it. Yeah. Something, an action sequence I hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm. So from that respect, I really enjoyed watching it.
At some point, we may want to go through some of the Jackie Chan earlier films, Rumble in the Bronx and stuff like that, because his action sequences are very kind of organic, using what's around them, and not the, man, I've seen this sort of a fight 100 times before.
Yeah.
And just some of the stuff he does defies explanation in a, I know he physically did it way, versus the, I know here they digitally did it kind of a way.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah. But this was fun. I'm glad we did it. It was fun to kind of watch this after having recently read the comic and kind of, you know, see how close they did and didn't match. And they were close thematically and structurally and very different in terms of one's clearly set in a superhero world and this one clearly set in a Hollywood blockbuster world.
But, you know, which world would you rather live in?
Given the villains won in the comic... This seemed like a generally safer place for the average person.
Okay, I'll take it.
Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.